side of the room, this side of the stage, my right-hand side, that which is the material world. And this side over here is that which is able to notice it, which is observing it. You can do the same with fatigue. I can laugh at fatigue. Because I am not that which is tired. I am not that which is hungry. As this woman said to my teacher, Nisargadatta, when she had cancer, I suffer so. He said, you do not suffer. He said, only the person you imagine yourself to be is suffering. And so you come to an awareness that this world over here, you know, when I was this little boy, 3 or 4 years old, and I was living out in Mount Clemens at 231 Town Hall Road with this lady, Mrs. Scarf, and my brother Dave was with me. She used to, we had a pathway that would lead up to the house. And on the left along the fence there was these lilies of the valley, and I cannot smell a lily of the valley today without going back to that experience. It was beautiful. I even bought my wife a big bottle of lilies of the valley perfume. I think it was at Kmart or something, and she said, what is this cheap stuff you're giving me? I said, it just reminds me of that moment, of those times. But on the right-hand side, we would plant tomatoes in the springtime. And I can remember, this was like yesterday. She would take this big silver-colored sprinkling can with the holes in the top and the spout and a digger and a whole bag of tomato seeds. And she would dig holes and then put the seeds in there and then cover it up, and I would pour the water on this little boy. And I said to her, where do the tomatoes come from? She'd say, they're in the seeds. I said, there's tomatoes in those seeds? She said, not exactly. I said, well, where are the tomatoes? Where do they come from? She said, they'll be, God will bring them. Well, when you're a scurvy elephant, that's not enough. And I can remember this, taking a handful of those little tomato seeds and putting them in my back jeans pocket and going out behind this chicken coop that we had there when I was all alone. And there was a little paring knife on that little table. And I took those seeds and I started opening those seeds, just cutting them open. And inside of those seeds was this dust, just this brown dust. And there was nothing that looked like or resembled a tomato in there. And I thought, where do the tomatoes come from? There's not anything resembling a tomato in there. All there is a potentiality for tomato, a future pull. And now I have learned since, having written about and studied quantum mechanics, that if you were to take that tomato seed dust and you were to put it under a microscope and examine it, you would see little particles and spaces. And if you took those spaces out and took the particles left and put those under a microscope of even stronger magnification and studied them, you would discover that there were more spaces and more tinier particles. And if you just kept doing that ad infinitum, until you got to the very last and the tiniest particle, past molecules, past atoms, past electrons, croutons, whatever else they had in there, protons, all of the stuff that's in there that you memorize, past the subatomic particles, smaller yet, quarks, and looked at the tiniest ones and put them in accelerator, particle accelerators, and slammed them together and took those particles and put those under an atomic microscope, and just kept doing it, eventually what you discover is there is nothing there. There is no thing in that tomato potentiality. It's just an energy. And that is what is the cause of everything over here in the physical domain. That energy. And all of us, because of our tribal consciousness, have made a decision that we don't know how to get into this world over here. We've forfeited our ability to be in this world, which is the world of co-creation, which is the world of manifestation, which is the world in which from here we no longer are at our physicalness. We're at something much grander than that. And when I finished this manuscript, and I was in this incredible state of awe and bliss at having been able to just sit down at a typewriter and allow it to come through me, with very few quotations and no case studies and none of the things that we call filler in the publishing world, where you make the book a little thicker by adding stories and so on. This is just like straight, this is what manifesting is about. I challenge myself to write it. Here's principle one, here's principle two, up through principle nine. And I sent the manuscript in, and my publishers were very content and happy and excited, and they showed me a design, and the book is going to be coming out, and they're very happy and so on. But they said, you don't have a display quote. A display quote is a quotation that you put at the beginning of the book that sort of summarizes what the book is about. You'll see it when you believe it. I had that quotation from John Quincy Adams about his body, and I am not my body. John Quincy Adams as well, but the house in which he lives is becoming dilapidated. But John Quincy Adams himself as well, thank you. And then he died. And as you, or as I, looked at the display quotes in my own books, in Real Magic, it was a poem from Samuel Taylor Coleridge. The poem said, what if you slept, and what if in your sleep you dreamed? And what if in your dream you went to heaven, and there picked a strange and wonderful flower? And what if, when you awoke, you held that flower in your hand? Ah, what then? And Larry, my editor up in New York, said, Larry Ashmead said, you don't have a display quote. And I was downstairs. We had taken, finished the writing, and I'd taken my family over to this hotel on Maui. We have a place that we live on the west part of Maui, but we took them over to Wailea. It's called the Grand Wailea. It's a real fancy, schmancy place. And I thought, well, instead of sending them all to college, we'll spend two nights in this hotel. Which is pretty much the way it was. And I had been up there the night before, and I'd been reading through, in every book in Maui, they have a lot of Oriental people coming there, so they have the teachings of Buddha, and then they also have the New Testament placed by the Gideons. And I was reading the teachings of Buddha, and then in there, there's this wonderful quote, and I went back up to the room, and I wrote it down. It says, the only effort of any intelligent person in this world should be the first and the foremost thing, how to know something which cannot be destroyed by death. How to know something which cannot be destroyed by death. And then I picked up the New Testament, and I always like to read John for some reason. St. John was a scurvy elephant himself, I think. And he had two quotes in there. Well, one of them says, is it not written in your law that I have said that you are gods? Is it not written in your laws that I have said you are gods? And later on in John, he says, and on that day you will know that I am in you, and I am in the Father, and you are in me. And those were the quotes that I placed at the front of the book, those two quotes. Because Jesus was not referring to his spleen and his beard and his sandals and his arms and his legs. He was referring to that which is in you and in the Father and in me. And once, how we misinterpreted, how we've taken this idea somehow and adopted this first theory of nature, which says that no, I am separate and inferior from that, and bought into that whole ego-driven thing that has caused so much division and so much sorrow and pain and suffering in our world, because we don't know. When St. Paul was in prison, chained to a Roman soldier after the crucifixion, writing to the Philippians, these people, to tell him about the ways of Christ, his words in Philippians 2, verses 5 and 6 were this. Have in you, he said, the same mind as Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God. To be equal with God. The two paradigms to transcend, to reach the stage of becoming a manifester, include taming the ego. Rabindranath Tagore, a great Indian poet, won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1927 with a collection of poetry called the Gitanjali. has this conversation with God. And he says, I went out alone on my way to my tryst. But who is this me in the dark? I step aside to avoid his presence, but I escape him not. He makes the dust rise from the earth with his swagger. He adds his loud voice to every word I utter. He is my own little self, my Lord. He knows no shame. But I am ashamed to come to thy door in his company. This person who adds his loud voice to every word you utter. This person who makes the dust rise from the earth with his swagger will never allow you to be at peace, because you can give it the greatest booze it's ever had and the greatest sex it's ever had and the greatest drugs it's ever had and the most beautiful car it could ever possess and the most beautiful women or the most beautiful and gorgeous men and the nicest home and the nicest clothes and trips to Saks and everything that you could ever want for yourself. You give it that and give it that, and the next morning after it's all worn off and you wake up, it will demand a whole new list. It is always, always asking for more. It lives on the premise that more is better. And it's why I call it a counterfeit freedom, because you never get enough. But when you know how to choose peace, when you are at peace in your life, this thing that keeps saying, yes, but I am so important, and virtually every addiction that you have, and I'll talk about this whole idea of virtually all of the things that our ego keeps us stuck in, keep us from being able to have that knowing, that divine knowing that says, I can indeed do all that any great spiritual master has done, and even greater things. But I have to not be needing to be right. I have to transcend that need of the ego, that self-importance, that belief that I am separate from, and understand that I am connected to. I am a piece of God. I am what God is doing. And I no longer have to be right. And you get to be free. The third pathway to mastery, after discipline and after wisdom and after school, when school is out, because that's where school stops, is the pathway of unconditional love. You now fall in love with what you do. You fall in love with it. It becomes you, you become it. When you are inspired in your life, when you're inspired, when everything is working, when you're writing or when you're cooking or when you're making love or when you're creating music or when you're in your dream state or whatever, and you're just like, you don't think about your body, you don't think about any aches and pains that it might have, you don't think about how old you are, you don't think about your finances and what the difficulties are, all of that is transcended. You are in the zone. You are in a zone where everything just seems to flow, and there's an overriding spiritual objective to all that you are doing. And you have this, like, you have discipline and you have wisdom, but you also are at peace. You are love. You are in harmony. You are congruent. There is no distinction between what you think and what you feel and how you behave. It is all one. It's the stage of unconditional love. And when you get to this place in your life, in anything that you are doing, you're way past just discipline and mastery and wisdom. And I want to tell you a story that has touched at my heart so deeply, a story of unconditional love that transcends anything I've ever known before in my life. A story that has moved me into a space of unconditional love that I didn't know existed within me. Last Christmas morning, 1995, I picked up the newspaper. The newspaper had a story. The story headlined, Woman Spends Her 26th Christmas in a Coma. I read the story. My daughter Tracy was down visiting us in Florida from Minneapolis. and my wife was there. The other children were off playing. And I said, Tracy, and I said, Marcy, come in here. I want to read this story to you. It's just so, it's Christmas morning. It seems so appropriate. And the story told of a girl who was 16 years old on the 3rd of January, 1970, 26 years ago, who was a diabetic, but it was controlled, and she was taking an oral form of insulin called diabenes. But as an adolescent, it wasn't reaching her bloodstream. And they didn't know that at the time. And she awoke around 2 o'clock in the morning, and she was in tremor. And she was in shock. And she was shaking, and her legs were twitching. And her mother and her father, her mother's name is Kay, and her father was Joe. And her younger sister was Colleen, who was 14 at the time. They drove off to the hospital very quickly. And they were in the hospital, and it was apparent that Eduardo was slipping away. And the day before, she had been a normal 16-year-old child. Everything was... She had been accepted to the University of Notre Dame as the first female in the female class to be admitted into Notre Dame. And she was a happy-go-lucky young girl. And she started slipping away, and she looked up at her mother, and her mother was there with her. Her mother's name is Kay. And her mother was holding her hand, and Eduardo looked up at her and said, Mommy, and she had never called her mommy before. She had called her mother. She said, Mommy, she said, you won't leave me, will you? And Kay said, I will not leave you. I promise. And a promise is a promise. I will be there for you. And then she slipped into this coma, and her eyes rolled back in her head, and she was in a stage one coma for several months. They had to tape her eyes shut at night. She was in such a deep coma. She was just catatonic, just rigid. And 26 years later, 1995 then, now 1996, she is still in a coma. And they made a decision, Kay and Colleen and Joe, that they would not put her into a home because they had promised her that they would never leave her. Now, they would have had all of their bills paid for had they been put in, she'd been put into a home, but they made the decision as a family that they would bring her home. This was 4 months later because they could no longer afford the care in the hospital, and their hospitalization and insurance had run out. She was a mathematics teacher, and he was a coach at a Catholic high school in Southern Florida. And I read the story, and the story also said that she has to be fed every 2 hours. That's 12 times a day. She has brain activity. And that over the past 25 years or 26 years, she had gone from being in this catatonic state to now being able to blink her eyes and now being able to recognize and to turn her head once in a while and to try to speak now and then, to even cry. And she was now in what they call a stage 9 coma, which was a stage that is sort of like when you're coming out of ether in surgery. You have an awareness of what is going, but you can't break through the curtain kind of thing, which is called the stage 9 of a coma. And the next stage, of course, is coming out of it. And I read this story, and the story, it's like you have to try to imagine, ladies and gentlemen, since 1970, 27 years now, never sleeping in a bed, but sleeping in a chair next to your daughter for 27 years and getting up every 2 hours to feed this child and every 4 hours to take her blood and give her insulin based upon what the reading was and to train yourself to do that. 6 years after this happened, the father, who was overcome with the debt that they were encountering, they were now over $300,000 in debt that they had borrowed and borrowed and borrowed and borrowed from shaky characters and gotten credit cards and more credit cards, and one in Kay O'Bear, one in Catherine O'Bear, one in Kay Catherine O'Bear, one in 32 different credit cards operating just to keep her daughter alive. She said she would do anything rather than allow her to die or allow her to not keep the promise that she had made. Never going to a movie in 27 years. Never going for a walk in 27 years. Never going outside of the home for anything other than medicine and being gone for no more than an hour. Never sleeping for more than 45 minutes. Every day for 27 years. And still going. And in those 27 years, the daughter had never had a bedsore because she had been turned every hour by her mother. And her hair braided and her legs shaved and kept in this immaculate condition. All through it, never complaining, never finding fault. One of the most positive, upbeat stories of unconditional love that I've ever experienced. And I was so touched by it, it was Christmas morning, that I took out a book that I wrote called Real Magic, and I signed it, and I wrote in there, "You are my hero." And I sent her a check for $1,000. And I thought I had really sort of done a nice Christmas thing. And then I, like we all do, I forgot. I let go. And I went away. She lives about 40 miles south of where I live. And I went away in January and February to write this book that I've been talking to you about. And one day while I was writing, about 3 weeks in, I turned on the TV for the first time. And on the show came, there was a show called Inside Edition that came on in the evening after the news with Deborah Norville, whom I and respected always. And she said, on the show today will be a woman whose daughter's been in a coma for 26 years. And they opened up the story with Kay reading to Eduarda from Real Magic in the opening line, which says, "This is a book about miracles." And there she was reading to her daughter from this book I had sent. And I had one of those sort of synchronistic moments, you know. And I said to myself, when I get home, I'm going to look that woman up. I don't remember her name or even where she lived, but I'm going to see if I can find her and perhaps I can do more. And I came back in February and there was a big stack of mail and the top letter on there was a letter from Kay thanking me for the book and the check and inviting me to come down. Well, I called her and talked to her and the next day my wife Marceline and I went down to see her. Now, a few years ago, Marcy and I went to Assisi in Italy with three of our daughters. It was a pilgrimage sort of for us in our marriage. It was I had always had a great fondness for St. Francis, the first person to experience the stigmata, the wounds of Christ, a man who just months after his death was made a saint by the Catholic Church, and that generally takes centuries to accomplish. A person who had these great healing capacities of animals and life and always would heal others, but never himself because he wanted them always to know it was God who was doing the healing. And I had read his biography called God's Fool and has always touched me very deeply. Talking about leaving the tribe, tossing off all of your clothes and going down into the piazza. My favorite movie ever is Brother Sun, Sister Moon, the Franco Zeffirelli version, which you can rent at Blockbuster. The Franco Zeffirelli version of St. Francis. What a powerful movie made back in the 70s. Brother, Son, Sister Moon. And so we went to St. Francis's Ponchuncula, the chapel where he had done all of his healing and where he had died in the 13th century. And when we walked into that little place where more prayer has probably been said in that room than any room on the planet, my wife and I looked at each other and we both broke into tears. The energy of love was so strong. The prayer that had been said there. There were people from China, from Africa, from Indonesia. There are large groups in the chapel, in a large chapel around this small chapel, all waiting to get in. And we went in and meditated together for 20 minutes. And it was life enhancing and nurturing, soul and nurturing and changing. And when we walked down to Kay's home and walked into Eduarda's room, we had the exact same experience. Because when I researched Eduarda's life, it turns out that she was like a little saint herself. She gave away all of her money that she ever got to everybody else that didn't have any money as a little girl. She took blankets down to the people who lived on the streets without even telling anyone else because she couldn't tolerate them being cold. She didn't know how to judge anyone ever, never found fault with anyone. She had a horse. She was given a horse by her father, and she couldn't ride it. She could only feed it and touch it and wash it and care for it, but she just felt it was a burden to be on it. It just was her way. She didn't condemn anybody who decided to, but for her, it had to be, I am with you, not on top of you and dominating you. This was the kind of person she was. And she carried books about the saints with her wherever she went and studied them and asked her mother always questions about the saints. And then she went into this coma. And I went out to Los Angeles shortly after that, after going down there and visiting her. And I was doing this show called Politically Incorrect. And I wasn't quite sure why I had done it. The show was, I had been on with some pretty bizarre characters, but then I got this letter after the show was over, and it says, I saw you on Politically Incorrect the other night. I found myself being angry with all the people who were taking humorous pot shots at you and your books. Then I watched you, your graciousness in the face of their egos, and I let go of my anger. Thanks for teaching me how to do that. And I knew why I had been on the show, with some people who were stoned and acting pretty bizarre and making salacious remarks about what I had done and so on. And I felt so at peace. And I had been at Eduardo's the day before. And then I got a call from my wife saying, call Kay. And I called Kay, and Kay said, could you come home tonight on the red eye and be here tomorrow morning? Oprah Winfrey's taping a show on people in coma, and we would love you to be on the show. So I flew home that night, and I came to her. I got off the airplane, and I went right over to their home down in Miami. And we taped the show. And the show aired, and the story was, the show revolved around this policeman who had been in a coma for 9 years in Tennessee and had a bullet in his head and suddenly just started talking after 9 years. And it was this miracle. He just woke up one day and started talking. And they had his brother and the relatives were on the show, and all of the people who had been in comas who had come out were talking about what a hardship it was and what a struggle it was and how hard it was for them after, because the person wasn't the same and all of this. And then Kay came on the show. And Oprah said, why do you do this? And she said, because God asked me to do it. And God never asks you to do anything you can't do. And she said, don't you feel it's a burden? She said, I am honored to serve my daughter in this way. I am honored to serve. And as she talked in this positive, upbeat way, she said, no one knows why. But then she told me the story after we got back from the show. And she said in 1991, she got up at 4 a.m. to give a 4 a.m. feeding, and there was a bright light in the bedroom. And she was afraid that someone had come to hurt Eduardo because other people had shot bullets into their home and had sent poison medicine saying, we're going to put her out of her misery. She's a vegetable, you should let her go. And Kay said, I've never seen a vegetable smile. And to let her go means to starve her to death. You expect me to stand there and watch my daughter starve to death for 3 weeks without feeding her? I wouldn't know how to do that. And her husband had died 6 years later, and Colleen, her younger sister, couldn't take it either. Became a crack cocaine addict. Ended up in prison. Kay raised a grandson, and every 2 hours, she was there for her daughter, turning her, feeding her, for a quarter of a century. And when I asked her what she would like if she had enough money, she said, I would just like to have enough money that one day, each week, I could sleep through and hire a nurse to take care of Eduardo during the night. That's the only thing I would like. That, to her, would be as rich as you can be. When you get into your bed tonight and take for granted you're sleeping through, think about Kay. And after I had become involved in this story, my wife had become involved in the story and the things that had happened, on Easter Sunday, we went down and we were singing to her. And I said to my daughter, Skye, sang to her, I Will Always Love You, the Whitney Houston song. And I said to Skye afterwards, I said, honey, come on, we have to go. It's Easter. Grandma's coming over, and we have to get home. A tear came to Eduardo's eye as I said the children had to leave. And they had been sitting up on the bed with her, holding her hand. And this morning in 1991, Kay told me that day on Easter Sunday that she had walked into the room, and there was this figure. And the figure was the Blessed Mother, whom she described in greater detail than I'm giving now. And she asked her after her initial fear, this vision that she saw, why is my daughter in a coma? And she said, your daughter is a victim soul. You'll have to find out what that means. And she called all around to the different churches. And finally she went to this cardinal called, whom she had known because she's a very strong Irish Catholic woman. And the cardinal said, where did you hear that term? And she said, well, I would rather not tell you, because she was always afraid that people would think she was crazy talking about ghosts visiting her in her home. And he said, well, that's a term that goes back to antiquity. It refers to people who take on suffering in order to teach compassion. And they choose it themselves, very much like Gandhi did when he would fast as people were rioting in the streets and refused to eat. He said, your daughter has done this. And when there's enough compassion and when her mission is completed, she will no longer be in her coma. And the miracles that have taken that she told me about, people who had brain tumors, who had come and Eduarda's hand had been placed on her for the night and went to have their surgery, and no trace of the tumor. That there's something divine and magnificent that has just touched me in such an incredible way. And I was meditating one day. My wife and I had been down there. We were taking food down to her. We were helping out financially. And this debt was just choking at her. And I thought, I'd really like to get her out of debt. Maybe that's the compassion that needs to be taught. And then I thought, what can I do? And I called Kay. I said, how would you like it if I wrote your story? And I told your story all across America as an example of unconditional love that is so powerful that it could really perhaps fulfill Eduarda's mission of teaching compassion. She said, I'll have to ask the Blessed Mother. And she has these conversations with the Blessed Mother. And she had been told that as long as she kept her faith, that the right person or people would show up in her life, and that all that she worried about would somehow disappear. And you don't know over the years how she has survived with celebrity auctions and cookbooks and borrowing from very shady characters, all in the name of just keeping her daughter alive. And the debts just kept going. So I said, I'm going to do it. And the Blessed Mother said, he's the one. He will do it with dignity. And I went away on April the 1st. I had 9 free days this spring. I went away on April the 1st, and I came back on April the 9th. And I wrote her story. And it's now out, and it's called A Promise is a Promise. The almost unbelievable story of a mother's unconditional love and what it can teach us. And I asked my wife, Marceline, to write one chapter telling a mother's love story, and how she understood what a mother would do. And I decided that there would be nothing coming to me from this. No profits, no royalties. All of it would go to the Eduarda Olvera Fund. And we'll put this book on the bestseller. And we'll get 1 million of them out there, and you'll make $2 million. The people who have interviewed me have said that it has transformed and touched their lives. People tell me it's the most inspirational thing they've ever heard or read. If you'd like to do your Christmas shopping and know that it's going to a wonderful cause and be inspired, pick up a copy or two of A Promise is a Promise. And what it has done for me, it has allowed me to get what's in it for Wayne Dyer out. And that's the greatest gift that I could ever be given, is to do something and take the talents and the skills that have been given to me and to put them to use for a cause like this. It's astounding and astonishing. Anyone you know who's experienced unconditional love towards you would value this. The three stages that I have presented for mastery up till now are the stage of discipline, or the practice of discipline, the practice of wisdom, applying the intellect to what it is that you are doing with your body. And then finally, the third one is this practice of unconditional love, of which Kay Olvera is a living model for us, as was St. Francis, as are so many people who have been in your life, particularly mothers. above themselves and ask nothing in return, which is what love is. And at the back of that book, A Promise is a Promise, is Kay's address. She would love to hear from you. She would love you to include her and Eduardo in her prayers. If you'd like to send her a donation of some kind, that would be most graciously accepted, even if it's a dollar. And she, thus far, although it's getting a pretty big job, has been able to respond to everybody who has written to her. She's a dynamo of a lady, I'm telling you. And the fourth stage, or the fourth pathway, if you will, to mastery is what is called surrender. And in learning to surrender in what you are attempting to master, what you are doing is you are surrendering the little mind to the big mind. It's as simple as that. It's what you are doing is you are reconnecting the little mind to the big mind. And I say little, I don't mean that in any degrading kind of way. But I mean it in terms of how the life force, how the universal energy, which is everywhere and always flowing and inexhaustible, has actualized itself in you. And what has happened with this idea that you have of your separateness is you have disconnected yourself from it. And in the process of disconnecting yourself from it through the teachings of the tribe and through your own life experiences and your own belief that this idea of your self-importance and your individuality and your separateness is more important and has to be taken care of all the time, it has kept you from reconnecting. And it's this reconnecting process that enables you to become that which is able to manifest. And it's this surrendering process is something that I can only tell you from my own experiences and from the experiences of people I have worked with over the years and my own family members and things like that. It is only something that you can come to know through trusting in it. You're not going to get it because I say it or because you read it someplace. There will still be, because it still constitutes a belief. It still constitutes what something coming from outside of you. And that always comes to you with an element of doubt. You have to know how to make contact. And that's what I want to talk about here. This principle of making contact. If you were to examine the physical domain and what it is like, the world of matter, the world of particles, the world of beginnings and ends, the world of form and dimensions, and size and weight, measurement, all of the stuff that we notice about each other and about ourselves and about our world, you would come to certain conclusions about this world. When you go to India, where I'll be in December this year with Deepak, meet these people, and when they refer to people like Nisargadatta or Ramana Maharshi or even Mahatma Gandhi, or they refer even to people such as Jesus Christ or Buddha or Yogananda or Vivekananda, they are often referred to in these revered terms that mean they are non-dual beings. Non-dual beings. And that's how they are referred to, as someone who has transcended the duality. So that's one of the things that I would like to have you take a look at here in this program or in this seminar, is how do you become a non-dual being? If you look at the physical world and all that is in it, that it is a world of duality. If it was always light, 24 hours a day, if it was light, we wouldn't have a concept called darkness, would we? We wouldn't know darkness. We wouldn't be able to describe darkness. We wouldn't think darkness thoughts. We would just know light. And so, in order to have light, you must have darkness in the physical domain. And everything in the physical domain is like that. It's like a wave that has a crest, and then it goes down, and it has a trough, and there's a top and a bottom, a nadir and a zenith, whatever you want to call it. There is this top of the wave and the bottom of the wave, and they are always separate. You can always find the wave. As long as you can measure it on a scope, you can find the wave. There's a top and there's a bottom. They are always separate, and they are always together. You can't separate them. You cut it off as thin as you can slice it, there's another wave, and there's a top and a bottom. Okay? This top and bottom notion of the physical world and all that is in the physical plane, very important to understand. It's like it symbolizes at the top of the wave is life, at the bottom of the wave is death. Life, death. They are always together. They are always separate. You can't have one without the other. If you were always happy 24 hours a day, if you were happy 24 hours a day, we wouldn't have a concept called unhappiness. In order to know something called happiness, we have to know something called unhappiness. Otherwise, it doesn't exist on the physical plane. And haven't you ever noticed that when you're really happy and things are really working out, there's usually some caca on its way, isn't there? It's just the nature of the physical plane, isn't it? I mean, you're not going to always be in that blissful, highest state all the time. You're going to, when you're in the physical plane, when you're over here on the right-hand side, when you're there, you are always going to experience ups and downs, hills and valleys. Can't have a hill without a valley. Can't have a valley without a hill. Have you ever seen a person with a front who doesn't have a back? Can't be, can it? No matter how anorexic, no matter how you do it, you still turn around and there's a back, isn't there? Have you ever seen a person with an outside who doesn't have an inside? A top without a bottom. Not possible. This is the nature of the physical plane. This duality. And very often we think that the top and the bottom are enemies of each other. Like most of us in the tribe have learned that death is the enemy of life. And we become absorbed in it. And we milk it. And we have all kinds of difficulties around it. And when people die, we are traumatized and we wail and we grieve and we go through all of this process thinking that death is the enemy of life. Whereas it isn't. It is the partner of life. You cannot have life without death. You cannot have death without life. Everything that has ever died must have what? Lived. Everything that has ever lived must die or have died. They go together. You can't have one without the other. Yet they are separate. Separate, but always together. Up and down. Good and bad. Right and wrong. Black and white. Male and female. All of it. All of the dualities. Okay? And when we begin to try to figure out a way to get out of this duality, or to be able to bring into the world of duality what we would like to be able to bring into it, we are talking about manifesting. We're talking about having it show up into our lives, what we would like to have show up. Or to get over what it is we don't like in our life, to be able to transcend it, to get past it. We're talking about figuring out a way to get to the place over here where the rules and the laws are so strong that they can alter and circumvent these rules of the dual plane.
This concludes side A. Please fast forward and turn the tape over to continue the program on the other side.